Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In the 4 years that followed Donald Trump's loss to Joe Biden in the presidential election of 2020, conservatives got busy, specifically those at the Heritage Foundation. They began designing policy initiatives to be put in place in the next right-wing administration. It was a compendium of conservative thought, a means to recruit like-minded thinkers, a vision for how the United States should operate in the world, and a detailed plan outlining how these policies should be implemented, policies that included expanding the power of the executive branch, making Congress an afterthought, and attacking the civil service. It came to be known as Project 2025. During the campaign, Donald Trump disavowed any knowledge of the plan, though its principal author was Russell Vogt, who would ultimately become Trump's director of the Office of Management and Budget and a key player in implementing the roadmap that is Project 2025 in the first year of this new administration. David Graham points out in The Atlantic, quote, "In the roughly 11 months since he took office, Trump has closely followed many parts of Project 2025, finally embracing it by name in October." And Graham adds, "Today it stands as the single most successful policy initiative of the entire Trump era. And it is one that is reshaping not just the executive branch, not just our democracy and the nation, but the world." This hour, a closer look at the blueprint laid out in Project 2025, how much of it has been implemented, what may be coming next, and how it is affecting all of us. David Graham is with us for that conversation. He is a staff writer for The Atlantic, author of the book The Project, How Project 2025 is Reshaping America, also an adjunct instructor of journalism and public policy at the DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy at Duke University. James Goodwin is also with us. He's interim co-executive director and policy director for the Center for Progressive Reform. That's a nonprofit working to harness law and public policy to create a responsive government, a healthy environment, and a just society. That's how they describe themselves. And Dawn Blagrove is an attorney and executive director at Emancipate NC, a criminal justice reform organization combining legal action, community organizing, and public education to forward racial justice. Thank you all for being here. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome. David, I'm going to start with you because, as I said, during the campaign, Donald Trump disavowed any knowledge. He's consistently denied any knowledge of Project 2025. And yet Russell Vogt and other key players in the administration also played a key role in his campaign. They were keenly aware of and involved in planning and implementing this roadmap. Did Donald Trump lie, or is he being manipulated by people behind the scenes?
Well, Trump says he didn't read Project 2025. And given his record of reading, I believe that. But his denials of any connection were really nonsense. If you look at the authors, roughly a quarter of them served in the first Trump administration, many of them in cabinet-level jobs. And many of them have gone on to serve in this administration, including in cabinet-level jobs. You look at somebody like Russell Vogt, you look at a figure like Brendan Carr, who is the head of the FCC and an unusually household name in this administration. He was an author of Project 2025. John Ratcliffe, the head of the CIA, Project 2025. You can go down the list. And I think you can also just look at the connections between what they lay out and what Trump has done in office. And you can see very clearly that he is following their blueprint fairly closely.
In your recent article in The Atlantic, you say that you started by saying a year ago, no one knew for sure whether Project 2025 would prove to be influential or if it would all fall by the wayside, like so many plans in Trump's first term. What does the fact that it hasn't fallen by the wayside say to you?
I think it indicates a couple things. One is we're in a really unusual situation. Not, you know, since the 19th century has a president had 4 years out of power to think about a president and his aides, to think about what they did wrong and what they would like to do better. And so I think this is partly a product of that. I think also it is about one of the major successes of Project 2025, which is personnel. They looked at the first Trump administration and they saw failures not, created by unpopular policies or by a president with personal flaws, but by a failure of personnel. That they had all these people who were rhinos, Republicans in name only, or Bush Republicans, and they wanted to have people around him who would enable him and sort of all be rowing together. And I think they've really effectively done that. And they've created a sort of symbiotic relationship where they get done what they want and he gets done what he wants.
But his first administration wasn't a failure by most standards until the pandemic came along and threw a corkscrew into everything. I know what you're saying. You're saying that there were people around him in the first administration that said, no, you can't do that. And so he didn't do it. Now there's nobody saying no to him. So he's doing anything he wants to. James, what does that mean? I mean, if he had just continued down the road of his first administration, he would likely have more an equal amount of success and perhaps be more popular than he is today.
So, I mean, I think that really demonstrates the difference between, or Project 2020-2025 really demonstrates the difference between the two terms, right? I mean, he came in to his first term with a policy agenda, right? But what Project 2025 is like an actual blueprint for rebuilding government to institute a really unpopular policy agenda. And that's what he lacked the first time, is he knew where he wanted to go. He didn't have a roadmap to get there. And Project 2025 provides that roadmap.
Dawn, I know you have a political bent, but his exercise of, and we'll talk about this as we go through the show, his exercise of some of these policy initiatives outlined in Project 2025 are extremely unpopular with the American people, and he has the lowest presidential approval rating of any president ever in history at the moment. A politician doesn't like to play to the negatives. He likes to be popular. Trump certainly likes to be popular. So why would he follow this roadmap?
First, I want to thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. But I just want to kind of level set and play a bit of a Debbie Downer here. I don't think this is a roadmap for a new set of policies. This is a roadmap for dictatorship. This is a roadmap for the end and the demise of democracy as we know it. And when you look at it through that lens, whether or not it is popular is of no consequence to a person who intends to become a dictator, because he doesn't need to have popularity among people who he controls unilaterally. I think that is the conversation that we should be having, and where this... What Project 2025 is about completely, it is about, at its very essence, it is about ending the three branches of government and consolidating all of that power into the executive branch. Now, we can call it whatever we want, but at the end of the day, what that is the demise of democracy and the rise of a dictatorship, which is what I think we're seeing. We are watching him with ICE build his own separate military. We are watching him infiltrate American cities and get people ready, especially ready in places where he thinks his base will not mind, for the occupation of the military. And I suspect that as we get closer to these 2026 elections, we're going to be hearing a lot more talk about martial law. So again, this isn't about changing democracy. This is about ending democracy.
I think James's head is going to snap off at the neck. He's been nodding so vigorously at most of what you've been saying here. I take it that you are on the same page.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely correct. I mean, in some ways, yes, this is a blueprint for bringing down the three coordinate branches, but it also found itself with a constitutional system that was already really fragile and really already sort of like had been degraded in so many ways. And so when you asked initially, like, how did Project 2025 really sort of find its feet so quickly? It's because it found itself in a system that was already primed for this kind of initiative to go. Our constitutional checks and balances, our separation of power, we're already essentially down for the count. So, I mean, what I think the Project 2025, the major agents behind it found themselves pushing on an open door. And that's why there's been so much success over the last year.
Another aspect of his ability to implement so many of these changes outlined in Project 2025, David, is the fact that this document contained pre-written executive orders designed for rapid implementation. In the first year, he began issuing a flurry of these orders, one after the other. Is that how he was able to do it? Somebody had already written them out for him?
Oh, very much so. I mean, I think what is interesting is, you know, we see these kinds of policy blueprints every 4 years from think tanks across the spectrum. What I think is a little bit different here is how they had thought about what they were going to do and how they were going to do it. And you had people like Russell Vogt who had deep experience in the government, which is not something that was true in Trump's first term for many of his aides, and were willing to use that. They were aware of how it worked, and they were going to work inside it, and they were going to sort of demolish it from the inside. And that has been very effective. They also understood, I mean, to Don's point, many of these things are so unpopular. And they understood that they were going to need to move fast in order to overwhelm Congress and overwhelm the courts and overwhelm public opinion. And so they didn't want to have a long, slow process where you start appointing people on day one. The one thing I would say also to add to what both Don and James were saying is this is very much a plan to create a sort of monarchical executive branch. But I would say beyond that, it is also a plan for, you know, for Trump, I think that kind of dictatorial power is an end in itself. He has a sort of instinctive pull toward it. But I think for the authors of Project 2025, their ultimate goal is a sort of Christian nationalist society. And that's a term I hesitate to use because it means a lot of things to many people. But Russell Vogt describes himself that way. So I think it's fair to do so. And so that's, you know, that's what they want to do with all that power they get.
One of the problems here with this, whether you believe this is happening as is, it is being described right now by this panel or not, is that it has this swift moving, it's almost like a coup, has happened so quickly and overwhelmed the Congress, and the Congress hasn't really played any role in this because it's controlled by Republicans who are on the same page. We don't seem to have the mechanisms in place to stop it very effectively. But one thing I think David just said, Don, was that it kind of has, I don't want to put words in his mouth, so let me rephrase it. Popular support. The popular support that it may have is among a very few number of people, it would seem to me. The problem is people simply don't believe what they're seeing with their eyes because it's never happened before. Is that the inherent danger in this? We simply don't see the danger because it couldn't happen here.
Absolutely. And I also want to take a little bit of issue on the idea that this all happened in the last 4 years or in the 4 years while Trump was out of office. We have watched conservatives in this country put in place and build systems, erode systems that have been a part of upholding democracy for at least the last 25 years, right? We have watched them put in place, you know, Supreme Court justices so that they could overturn Roe v. Wade. This is a long-term strategy that is just coming to fruition in this moment. But I think the importance about this particular moment and what those people in charge actually realize, and if you look at America, at not even at American history, if you look at world history and you watch the rise of these types of dictatorships and these radical shifts in government, what you find is that there is always a certain recipe that exists. That recipe is, you know, a poor economy and the feeling of, in America, for white folks to be feeling scared. So what we're seeing now, if we look at history, we know where we're going.
With that, we have to stop. We have to take a break at Charlotte Talks on WF. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the rollout and implementation of and the impact of Project 2025 and what the future may hold as the next 3 years unfold under the Trump administration. We're talking about it with David Graham. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic and author of How Project 2025 is Reshaping America. Don Blagrove is with us, an attorney and executive director of Emancipate NC, and James Goodwin, interim co-executive director and policy director for the Center for Progressive Reform. And James, in his article, David quotes Paul Dans, who just happens to be running for Congress here in North Carolina, one of Project 2025's leaders, as saying that the effectiveness of achieving the plan's goals has gone way beyond his wildest dreams. And you've called the result of this, in terms of the pain that has been inflicted, quote, breathtaking. And that pain stems, I guess, from the resulting transformation of our normal regulatory system into one of more approaching an authoritarian system. Your organization, the Center for Progressive Reform, has set up a tracker to monitor the administration's progress in implementing Project 2025. How have you been tracking that success, and what have you found?
Yeah, so Project 2025 first came on my radar screen because this detailed blueprint for using this arcane body of law called administrative law, which even most lawyers don't like to think about, let alone average Americans. And it was all about weaponizing this body of law to institute an authoritarian system of government, right? It's very subtle. It can be very subtle. It can be very complicated. And so just that this would be like the weapon of choice, right, was in itself like really remarkable. So what my colleagues and I did is we went through all the domestic policy agencies, pulled out line by line every conceivable administrative action, not legislative action, actions that the president could theoretically take on his or her own to advance the Project 2025 agenda. We just made a big list. And now we're going through and systematically tracking the implementation of those recommendations. And this involves looking at the Federal Register, which I know is everybody's favorite thing to do, digging into press releases, digging into guidance documents, memos, the kinds of things that are hard to find on agency websites. And so what we found so far is of the 530 actions that we've identified, they've implemented or are in the process of implementing 53% of them. And there's a couple of other trackers out there that have their own methodologies and look at different scopes of actions that have more or less the same results. So I guess that's kind of indicative that we're all on the right track.
I misspoke a moment ago. Paul Dans is not running for Congress in North. He's running for Congress in South Carolina. Another person with the name of Dan is involved in this, and that is Dan Bishop, because he is Russell Vogt's second in command. He's a former Mecklenburg County Commissioner. He's a former member of the State House, a former member of the State Senate, one of the most conservative members of our General Assembly, and the author of the so-called bathroom bill. And he was also a member of the Freedom Caucus in the United States Congress from North Carolina. What role is he playing, James, in the implementation of Project 2025?
I mean, and that's part of the problem is we don't really know what everybody is doing, right? I suspect he is. For Vogt, he's really the expert on like the policy minutia, the mechanisms, and particularly on the budgetary side, but he's really going to need extra loyal folks who reach down into different agencies. And I suspect that that's the role that Bishop is playing.
Again, we all grew up in this country where we thought we were the beacon of democracy and that everybody was on the same page. And it dates back to George Washington giving up power voluntarily and Thomas Jefferson's famous words in the Declaration of Independence and all the founding fathers, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. But anybody who has listened to the series of podcasts produced by Rachel Maddow knows that there has been a strain of authoritarianism that has been running through people in this country for generations. And in fact, the 20th century, this is not the first time this strain has reared its head. And in the 20th century, before World War II, they were gaining traction. And then suddenly they were kind of snuffed out for a long time, but not through any maneuvers that the legal system was able to put on them, Dawn. So when you say this has been in the works for years, is that what you're talking about? And what has allowed it to reemerge?
So yes, and yes, and yes. But I do want to say this about authoritarianism. Let's just be clear. Authoritarianism is not new to America. It's new to white America. Black people in America, since the time that we got to this country, have been living under authoritarian regimes. We have always lived in an authoritarian regime, and America has always been very comfortable with authoritarianism as long as it does not touch or impede on white privilege. And what we are seeing now is that impeding on white privilege, and that is why it has become such a huge talking point. But it is not new in America. Secondly, I think, and speaking of race, I don't think we can talk about any of this without talking about the undergirding of racism and how necessary it is for this plan to move as rapidly as it has. So many of these dog whistles that have been dog whistles and have now turned into full out, just full throated acclamations of white supremacy, i.e. your president saying, our president saying that the civil rights era hurt white people in America. It set white people back. It is that kind of ideology that is why this is able to move forward as quickly as it has. And we cannot have this conversation without addressing that elephant in the room.
James.
Yeah. And so one of the things that Project 2025 does is it tries to take every institutional or every social pocket of potential pocket of oppositional power to the president, right? And find some way to neutralize it, some way to commandeer it, halt it, whatever. So that's why you see higher education, legal profession, the media, the press, and but also civil society, right? And so this is what's so interesting about the way it sort of weaponizes racism and racial hierarchy. I mean, it's an end in of itself, but it's also a tool for how it accomplishes that. In one of the ways you diffuse social opposition or general public opposition is by leaning on things like racial hierarchy and racial division. So the folks are so busy fighting amongst themselves that they're allowing this authoritarian regime to essentially march unimpeded.
David, when you wrote your article, is this what you saw? I know the article's called How Project 2025 is Reshaping America, but do you see these same devils lurking in the shadows, this move toward authoritarianism? Because it seems to me that if he is successful in transforming the presidency and making it the authoritarian dictatorship that some people see he's trying to do, it is conceivable he could lose the next election. And then a Democrat would take over and have those same powers, which would put them in a sticky wicket.
Yes, I think this is a bit of a flaw in the thinking. And it's something that you don't hear the authors addressing a lot. And I think there's a couple things going on there. One is a certain amount of short-sightedness. And two is a sense that they are trying to move the goalposts so far that you know, it will be very hard for them to win an election. There won't be the same sort of opposition. There won't be the kind of infrastructure for that. Or even if they do, they will have moved the federal government so far towards their vision that it will still be a net positive for them. But I mean,
are we seeing moves already to not end elections, because dictators have elections?
Sure.
They just rigged them. But we keep hearing that our elections are not reliable. They are, in fact, rigged when he doesn't win. And we are seeing him say that we will have voter ID, whether the Congress wants it or not, meaning that he's going to control what he said. Already said that Republicans should control the elections. He said that after, if you elect me, you won't need elections anymore. Is that where we're headed?
Yes. I mean, you see a series of, we have been seeing assaults on elections and on civil society, to James's point, in ways that undergird elections for the entire term. And in the last few weeks, we've seen it really amped up, whether that's talking about nationalizing elections in certain states, fights with states over seizing voter rolls, these claims that he's going to institute voter ID, which is not a power the president has, but, you know, he has attempted to and sometimes successfully asserted powers that are not granted to him in the past. And even if you look at gerrymandering, it's an attempt to shift elections away from fairness. So I think there's a whole range of things designed to make elections unfair.
So there have been a lot of power grabs over the last year, extraordinary power grabs, some laid out in Project 2025, perhaps some not, but nonetheless, he's taken what he wants. And the Republicans in the Congress, they control the Congress. The Democrats have griped about it, but they don't really have any power. And the Republicans have said nothing for the most part until very, very, very recently. And it's only a minority of Republicans in Congress who are mouthing off about this. Does that mean that the entire Republican Party is on this page? They want to move toward autocracy. David.
I think that they are either on this page or they're willing to go along with it. You know, Trump has one reason they've been so successful is Trump has the entire Republican coalition so much under his thumb, and he has so many of these members of Congress running scared. I don't think any other president could have accomplished as much as he has in this term because no one else can keep the Republican coalition together. And I think that's another of the weaknesses of Project 2025 in the future. After Trump, it's hard to imagine what figure can unify them.
Dawn.
My take on this is a little different. It frightens me that there are people in the Republican Party who are publicly breaking, even though it's just a few, because here's what I believe. I believe that the vast majority of them thought that he had all these plans and they were very outlandish and they just couldn't happen. And so, but my voters like him, my constituents like him, I want to hold on to power, I'm going to go with him. I think we're getting to a place in this evolution of our government where those people closest to it are understanding that what is happening so rapidly, and it is not what they thought it was going to be, that this is going to a place that is very anti-democratic, and they're trying to jump off the ship. That scares me because they don't see a way to turn it around, and that is frightening to me. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I said, if you're talking about people in Congress, they have the power. They could stop this.
They could stop it. But again, I don't think they want to. Okay. They don't want to. They want to maintain the power. And if they're reading the tea leaves, and what the tea leaves say is that we are headed towards this monarch of sorts, then they want to make sure that they are on the right side of the king. And that is frightening to me. They don't want to change this. And there's no real way that they can. And let's just be clear. We have a United States Supreme Court who issued an opinion that said this president can do anything and has full immunity. And anyone who works for him or is working at his behest has full immunity. Right? That we have seen him write executive orders that are so outlandish, but still gum up the works and get put into place because they take advantage of the slowness and the archaic nature of our judicial system, right? And even still, once it gets to the Supreme Court, even the most outlandish things, we're not sure are going to be upheld constitutionally anymore. There has been such an erosion of our systems of checks and balances that anyone who is more concerned about holding on to power than they are about the country, is going to bend that knee. Look, I've been saying for a long time, I wrote my master's thesis on Nixon and Watergate. We don't have Nixon Republicans anymore. We don't have the type of Republicans that are going to put the country first.
You don't have a Barry Goldwater walking into the Oval Office saying you must resign because we're going to impeach you. James, the expansion of presidential power when it comes to Project 2025 appears to be essentially Article 1, Section 1 of the handbook. It envisions an executive free to operate as it chooses and a compliant bureaucracy marching to the president's orders. But it also says, quote, above all, the president and those who serve under him or her must be committed to the Constitution and the rule of law. This is Project 2025, adding that if conservative administrations don't respect the Constitution, no administration will. And it goes on to say that the White House counsel, quote, must take seriously the duty to protect the powers and privileges of the president from encroachments by Congress, the judiciary, and the administrative components of departments and agencies. Equally important, the president must enforce the Constitution and laws as written, rather than proclaiming a new law unilaterally. Which begs the question, is Trump really following this document's plan, or is he picking and choosing?
So here's the way you sort of break through this contradiction, right? The sort of operating system that all this is running on is something called the unitary executive theory, mm-hmm. right? This is this idea that the Constitution endows the president and the president alone with all Article II authorities, and essentially no other branch could encroach on that. That, of course, raises a question of what is the scope of Article II authority. And of course, that just sort of expands quicker than the NBA, right? It just goes on and on. And that's what we're sort of seeing over the last year, is things that were like conventionally seen as overlapping between, say, Congress and the president are now only the president, right? So things like budget, appropriations. But what he's essentially saying here is that, yes, they're following the Constitution, but it is the president's interpretation of what the Constitution that matters, right? So this assertion that the president has this almost unchecked authority to state what the Constitution means, which of course would be of great shock to Article III Supreme Court justices who previously thought they had that power. But honestly, like the real history is that everybody, all three branches, have some role in asserting the meaning of the Constitution. Project 2025, through President Trump, is asserting that no, the president alone has that. And he's even issued executive orders to that effect, right? So he issued this executive order just really in the weeds, technical sort of thing about independent regulatory agencies, right? You need not worry about the details. But what's really incredible about this executive order is that it says that the president, or you know, anybody who he delegates, has the last word on how those agencies interpret the law, implicitly including the Constitution. So that's how you resolve that Constitution. Yes, we're following the Constitution, but it is our Constitution.
So the question arises, is there a remedy for this? If you believe in democracy as it has been exercised here since the beginning of the Republic, is there a remedy? Is there a backstop which brings into focus the midterm elections? Because that's the first backstop. And there seem to be threats to the outcome of that election, which we'll talk about when we come back. Because if you believe what is being said today, democracy is unquestionably under threat. What are we going to do about it? We'll come back with that and more in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Project 2025, its implementation, its impact, and what may be to come here with James Goodwin, Interim Co-Executive Director and Policy Director for the Center for Progressive Reform, Dawn Blagrove, an attorney and Executive Director of Emancipate NC, and David Graham, a staff writer with The Atlantic, whose latest article is How Project 2025 is Reshaping America. So the Democrats, David, have often been described by some as hapless. And maybe that's true, but maybe it is simply that there's so much that's been coming at them that is so extraordinary and out of the ordinary and unprecedented, to use a tired word, that they don't know how to react. And people have criticized Merrick Garland in the last administration for acting far too slowly because he was trying to heed to the norms. We don't prosecute our politicians for doing things in office. We just don't. And so he could have made it so that Donald Trump could not run again or hold any office again, but he didn't. Is there a remedy for this outside of elections? And is there a remedy in elections if some of the orders in Project 2025 and the executive orders and the threats being posed by Donald Trump to these elections come true?
I think elections are the most important thing. What we've seen is that Congress is unwilling to, Republican Congress is unwilling to protect even its own prerogatives. such as the power of the purse. The courts are generally not willing to stand up to Trump. And in fact, an acquiescent Supreme Court is assumed as part of Project 2025's plans in many cases. So I think, you know, voting is the most important thing. People need to create, have a Congress that is willing to exercise oversight. But I think it's insufficient. I mean, we have to look at a years and decades long plan to rebuild things like an independent regulatory state and to rebuild the power of Congress, which the authors of Project 2025 correctly identified as having sort of shriveled and, you know, having yielded up lots of its power. If we want democracy to work, we're going to need to think about how we can create a Congress that does work again.
Dawn, go ahead.
Which I think leads directly to us going back to the Constitution, right? And to our forefathers who said and told us that this was an exercise, an experiment, and that at some point it would need to be revisited, right? I am going to use the R word right now, and I don't want everybody to be afraid, but it is time for a revolution. Now, whether that be a physical revolution or an intellectual revolution, it is time for us as a nation to take a pause and rethink and rebuild what democracy actually looks like. And that is what is being shepherded in by this president. And America has to rise to the occasion. Either we acquiesce and become a dictatorship, or we do what our founding fathers anticipated would be needed, and we do the Revolutionary Act of collectively rebuilding. I think that is what is going to have to happen. I think that is where we are ultimately headed. And I am prayerful, but also have my passport ready if we are not, that the American people are ready to meet the challenge.
So, James, it's fairly clear that Donald Trump has an authoritarian streak. It's part of his personality long before he ever was a politician. He likes to run things. He likes to be the big kahuna. He likes to be the focus of all the attention and suck up all the air in the room. His way is the right way. He's never made a mistake. He will tell you that himself, and he has said it out loud. Which is more frightening, the fact that this could be an authoritarian country or an oligarchy, because he's clearly helping his moneyed interests get their way, and not just in AI, but on Thursday, he essentially stripped the country of any regulations with regard to the environment.
Yeah, you know what? I think there really is. It's not really an either or. They're kind of a symbiotic systems, right? Because with so much of what Project 2025 strive to accomplish is really dependent upon like powerful wealthy interests, right? And so what's sort of interesting about Project 2025 is it's a fossil, right? It was written in 2023 in a world that's really, really different from January 2025 when Trump was inaugurated, right? So we didn't have the campus protest around Palestine. We didn't even know Elon Musk was a Republican yet at that point. Doge wasn't a twinkle in anybody's eye, right? But when you look back at the first few months of what Trump was able to accomplish, you know, Doge, Musk was a big part of that, right? And I think that just illustrates the symbiotic relationship between oligarchy and authoritarianism. And you see this in places like Russia and Hungary as well.
And looking back on Doge, it was not about saving money. It was about breaking things and bringing the bureaucracy to heel and then filling that bureaucracy with loyalists who would do the bidding of the president, whoever that president happens to be. And David, we've seen that. We've seen attacks on free speech. We've seen attacks on the media and people in it. We've seen attempts to control the Fed, which was intended to be apolitical for a very good reason. We've seen the weaponizing of the Justice Department, the emergence of this pay-to-play philosophy that appears to make it look like the White House is for sale, and probably is. Is all of that in Project 2025, or is that merely Donald Trump just giving in to his grifter instincts?
Well, I think you can't necessarily separate those. And I think Project 2025 is designed in part you know, to work with somebody like Trump. And so if you are Trump, what you get is a cadre of loyal employees and a policy agenda and ways to achieve the few things he really cares about: retribution, immigration enforcement, tariffs. These are the things that are near and dear to him. And then they have their own agenda. And what they get out of it is they get power. And so these things, I think, intertwine in the same way that oligarchy and authoritarianism do. Even if they don't have quite the same goals. Trump's goal may be to enrich himself. Their goal is to set up a sort of theocratic society. But they realize that they have common cause, at least for these next 4 years, and are moving towards the same goal. And I mean, that's true. You know, the liberal media is both a threat to your Christian social society, but it's also a threat to a Republican president like Trump. So they have common enemies.
Yeah. Over the last several years, we have seen Republican-controlled states, including ours, make changes or attempt to make changes in the voting rules from requiring voter ID, which I think most people in the country are okay with, as long as there are exceptions for people who are too old to have a driver's license or things like that. But now it seems to be moving in to proving citizenship. And it may impede women who have changed their name because they got married and their birth certificate may not comport with their current name. We've heard Trump say that elections should be run by Republicans. We've seen gerrymandering on a serious scale, although the Democrats are fighting back in some states. This appears to be part of a long thought out strategy, Dawn. Is it?
Yeah, it absolutely is. I don't think there's any question about that. I think that what we are seeing, and as it relates to voting and access to the ballot, again, these aren't new tactics. These are just tactics we've never seen used writ large in America. I think the, and I would push back against the voter ID being something that most people agree with, because I think the problem that we have, like here in North Carolina, where the mechanics of voting is determined and controlled and regulated by people locally. And what you will find is that our General Assembly here in North Carolina has put in place so many right-wing Republicans who are controlling the electoral process that even when you have a rule like voter ID that looks very innocuous and objective on its face, it is the application of those rules and the application of those laws that create the negative impact, right? And I think most people understand that. The voter ID in North Carolina is being used very much like the bowl of jelly beans that Black folks used to have to count in order to get access to the ballot, or being able to recite and write out portions of the Constitution. While that seemed innocuous on its face, right? In application, what it did was disenfranchise huge swaths of the population based on race, based on gender, based on sex. So again, we aren't seeing something new here in America. We're just seeing it being applied much, much broader.
David.
I just wanted to add to what Dawn is saying. There is an important racial dimension to Project 2025. They talk about demolishing civil rights law. They use sort of wokeness and DEI as a big target rhetorically. But I think we also can't separate that from the gender side of this, which you brought up with voting. I mean, this is an idea of a society where women stay home and raise children and men are in the workforce, rollback of women's reproductive rights. And so those things, as they appear in voting, as they appear in policy, I think they're all tied up together. And it's a broader sort of civil rights thing. When you're attacking civil rights enforcement on race, you're also attacking civil rights enforcement on the basis of gender. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is now pursuing mostly claims of anti-Christian discrimination. So all of these things really do wrap together.
Yeah, make no mistake. What they are trying to build is a real life.
Handmaid's Tale.
Not even just Handmaid's Tale, Mad Men, right? Where you can slap women, they stayed at home. You know what I mean? You could talk like we are looking for Handmaid's Tale
the Epstein files be the wrench in that work in that plan? Because it seems that most people on the left and right, except those sitting in the White House and in the Justice Department, want every piece of information out of that file they can get their hands on, and they want punishment to ensue. Could this be the fly in the ointment?
No.
Okay.
Because if it were going to be, we would have seen it already, just like we've seen it. The implications, there are international implications of the Epstein files. Okay. And all over the rest of the world, we have seen swift responses. We have not seen that here.
Something
America
else
is not as moral as it appears to be.
Something else that we've seen recently, David, is the military in our streets. Not necessarily the United States Army, but the National Guard and ICE and the Border Patrol. And they're using tactics that we have never seen in American streets before. And what appeared to be just a way to get the worst of the worst of these illegal immigrants off the street has proven to not to be the case. It's they just want to be bullies. And I think they are, it's becoming a normal sight. It was shocking at first. Now it's normalized because it's come to Chicago. It's come to Charlotte. It's come to Minneapolis. It's come to Raleigh and other places around the country in advance of a midterm election. And you have written, David, about the 2026 midterm and the potential for chaos. You were on this program back in December to talk about that. Are you more worried about voter intimidation or about Trump and his allies refusing to accept the outcome or descending on elections officials and commandeering the votes or intimidating voters with troops at the vote polling places or even having House Speaker Mike Johnson refuse to turn over the gavel should Democrats retake the House?
I mean, I think all of the above are a concern. Maybe the gavel least of those, but all of those go together. And what we see is an administration willing and interested in trying all of the things they can possibly do. In a close election, they know many of these things will fail. You will get resistance like we've seen in Minneapolis and elsewhere. You will see court rulings against it. But you try a bunch of different things and you hope that in a tight election, those things make the marginal difference that can hand the election over to you. And I think that's the overarching strategy.
Do you fear that the election will be on the up and up or that they will simply seize the ballot boxes in areas that do not vote Republican?
I think there has never been a perfectly free and fair election in this country or anywhere else. But I do worry about it being so unfree and so unfair that it does warp voters' will.
So, James, if by some chance, despite fears about the midterms, the Democrats retake the House or even retake the House and Senate, do you believe that they will act quickly to end these efforts and reverse other efforts that have already taken effect as a result of Project 2025? Or will they take a more laissez-faire approach, a more this is how we do things in America approach, and take more of an interest in restoring decorum and unity over putting a stop to things that are just destroying the democracy?
I mean, I guess it depends on who's elected, right? If there's a lot of younger folks who are elected and there's indications that there might be a generational turnover in Congress, I think that could dictate how things play out. You know, I share the concern that there's going to be a muted response, but something that my organization is working on, and I urge other organizations to do the same, is to hold their feet to the fire. I mean, so like David pointed out at the beginning, organizations like mine put together presidential transition plans, right? Nobody reads them. They don't make the news. We don't have radio shows about them, sadly. But why don't organizations put together congressional transition plans? You know, I'm looking at committees I really care about, like House Judiciary and Senate Homeland Security, and I'm going to put together transition plans. I'm going to say, this is what I want to see you guys do if and when you get majority power. These are the oversight hearings I want to see. Here are the kinds of witnesses I think you should pull in. Here are the kinds of narratives. You know, like I said before, unitary executive theory. I would love to see like a joint Senate House Judiciary Committee, big grandstanding sort of thing, three sets of hearings, all focused on the unitary executive theory, right? Picking it apart in theory and practice, and then coming down with, no, this is the way things actually are. Article One really is has primacy in policy.
But if you have a Supreme Court who is in his pocket, won't they just veto that?
Yeah, but we have a long tradition in our constitutional history of Congress asserting their own constitutional rights prerogatives. And there's going to be a butting of heads, a butting of the coordinate branches. But that's exactly what the founders wanted, right? And this can be messy. We may lose at first, but over time, you build up public support behind that.
As I said at the beginning, we could do this for 3 or 4 hours, and I haven't scratched the surface here. It's all very scary, and I'm not even going to ask you if you're optimistic that we can survive as a democracy, because I don't want to leave everybody in the dumps. David Graham, staff writer for The Atlantic, How Project 2025 is Reshaping America. James Goodwin, policy director for the Center for Progressive Reform. And Don Blagrove, executive director of Emancipate NC.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.